Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Bernice McFadden, author of Praise Song for the Butterflies. We'll also hear from poet Ann Babson, whose new collection is Polite Occasions. Bernice McFadden is the author of 10 novels. Her first was Sugar, published in 1999. She received the prestigious NAACP Image Award for her fantastic novel, The Book of Harlan, which told the story of an African-American jazz artist who found himself imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. It's been optioned for a film. Cannot wait. Bernice teaches creative writing at Tulane University, and today we're talking about her beautiful and important new book, Praise Song for the Butterflies. Bernice McFadden, I'm so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you draw so much of your work from history, and I love the way you depicted the events in the Book of Harlan. You make history feel urgent and important, and you make the reader feel as though they were right there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important to you.
It is. And I feel like when I'm writing the book, when I'm creating, that I am right there. So I'm very visual. And so I see and I put what I see down on the page. So I'm glad that it translates to the reader in the same way.
Oh, yes. Now, in Praise Song for the Butterflies, you take the reader to, is it You Can Be?
You Can Be.
You Can Be. A fictional African country that feels very real indeed. And this story had its origin in a trip you made to Africa.
Yes.
So I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about that journey.
So You Can Be is actually modeled after Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, when I sat down to write the book, I had the story set in Ghana, but African society is very complex. And luckily, my publisher sent the manuscript to a Ghanaian woman who read it, and she was like, no, you can't do X, Y, and Z. And so I was like, okay, I'll create a fictional country. This way I can have creative license, because clearly I did not want to insult the Ghanaian culture. So I went to Ghana in 2007, with the National Book Club Conference. A bunch of readers went over and we really enjoyed ourselves and we visited all of the tourist sites. The one place I did not get to visit was a rehabilitation center in Ghana. And actually, I didn't even know it existed. And two women, Imelda Price and Linda McKenzie, said to me afterwards, he was like, you should have, you know, visited this rehabilitation center. And I don't know why I missed the trip. And they started explaining to me what the center was for. And the word Trakosi kept coming up. And I was like, well, what does that mean? Explain that to me. And essentially, it's slavery.
Right.
And so the women said, you should really write about this. And that's not my process. People can't just come up to me and say, you should write about this. You know, as writers, we get that a lot.
Oh, yes.
and so I was just like, you know, I kind of dismissed it. But then I got home and I started doing my research and I was like, this is fascinating. And I started writing about it.
Oh, so many issues about women and girls come to us from Africa. Female circumcision, the kidnapping of the girls by Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. And now you're teaching us about ritual servitude.
Yes, yes. I think that people should be aware of this. It's something that's not only in Ghana. I think it happens in about 3 or 4 West African countries.
So describe what it is for people who don't know.
So ritual servitude is basically if a family has fallen upon some bad luck. The old tradition says that you have to take one of your virginal daughters to a shrine and basically give that child over to the priest of the shrine. And that child will remain there as atonement for whatever sins an ancestor had committed. And so this is supposed to make everything okay, right? And that child will stay in the shrine until she dies. And when she dies, the family then has to replace her with another child.
Shocking.
Yes.
So shocking.
Yeah.
Oh. Now, Abeo, who is your main character, could be any girl, anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a daughter, don't you?
I do.
And so what did you draw on to create this vibrant, smart, interesting young woman?
I absolutely thought about my daughter, and I thought about my niece, and I thought about myself, and I thought about my mother.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a family of women. And so I think Abeel comprises all of the best things that we are in my family. And so it was a pleasure to write her, but it was also heartbreaking
yes.
to have to put her through what she had to go through.
Now, one of the things that makes this novel work, I think, is how brilliantly you depict the contrast in her life. Because she begins as a child of privilege, living in a city,
mm-hmm.
smart, confident in her family and her parents' love for her, and then the brutal deprivation of her life as a female slave. These are two worlds that could not be farther apart.
Yes, absolutely. I think the other thing that was on my mind while I was writing this book was I was just thinking about slavery as I am familiar with it,
mm-hmm.
how it happened right here in America. And I think that Abeel's story is not very different from my ancestors who came over here in chains. They were taken from their lives, whatever those lives were. I don't know if, you know, poverty was actually a thing before colonialism, but then brought here. So, you know, when we say, well, the slaves were brought over, we say, no, it wasn't slaves who were brought over here. There were the kings and queens and scientists and astrologers. And so that's, I think, what actually fed me as I wrote the story. That's what I was familiar with, and I had to draw from what I was familiar with.
Now, this is a very spiritual work, as mm-hmm. many of your books are.
Mm-hmm.
And it concerns a deep, you know, challenging spiritual journey. So I wonder if you'd talk about that aspect of your writing.
Mm. So whenever I write, and this is what I tell my readers, I don't outline, I don't plot, because for me, it is a spiritual event. It's me communing with my ancestors and them taking my hand and leading me through the story. And whatever they don't give me, that's then when I do what it is I do, is I fill in those little spots that, you know, they've left empty for me.
And how does this book feel like a step forward to you? How did you know this was the right thing to undertake on your writing path?
I never know.
Never?
I never know what's right and what's wrong. I just go with my gut. I go with the spirit. So, you know, I hope that it was the right thing to do.
Feels right to me. I mean, oh, now you write different types of books under pseudonyms. You've written romance novels, all different kinds of things. Does that give you a kind of freedom, you think?
It does. So my Geneva Holiday persona, I call
yes.
that my humorous erotica. So I get to tackle two things that I enjoy, humor and erotica. It is very different from writing as Bernice McFadden. It's not as cerebral,
uh-huh.
I guess. It's a lot of fun. I do quite a bit of eavesdropping when I write under Geneva Holiday. And it's like taking a holiday.
It really literally,
is. Yes. Yes, it is.
Now, how long have you lived in New Orleans now?
It's 2 years this month.
And, you know, how has being here affected your writing life?
Well, you know, New Orleans is very interesting. It's contained in one aspect and then in the other, it's not. There's this kind of wildness in the air. And of course, it's very spiritual here. I visit the cemeteries quite often. I think the people are amazing. And the idea that they don't worry about the future. And I understand why that is. And they actually live in the moment in a way that I've not seen in a lot of other places. And so, yeah, I'm enjoying being here.
So are you feeling New Orleans change you?
Oh, absolutely. Now, I don't know how I've been changed yet. I think that's going to be something that I'll see in hindsight. But I'm allowing myself, I think, to become a part of the fabric of the city.
Excellent. Well, we are lucky, lucky to have you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Bernice McFadden, whose new book is Praise Song for the Butterflies. You can meet her Fridays, September 7th from 6 to 8 at Community Book Center. That's at 2523 Bayou Road. Bernice, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're my butterfly. Don't fly away, butterfly. Where you go, butterfly? Would you be my butterfly? Butterfly, figure eight, butterfly, my African butterfly.
Anne Babson is a New York poet and a Southern writer, all rolled up into one complex person. She teaches at Southeastern Louisiana University, and today we're talking about her new book of poems, Polite Occasions. Hi, Anne. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi. It is so amazing to be here. I love your show. I love the questions you ask other writers, and I'm, you know, half terrified, half delighted at what you're going to ask me.
Don't be terrified. Now, I have to say, the cover of this book says it all. In stark black and white, you've got an elegant birdcage, you have a string of pearls, and then you have a bomb with a burning fuse. So it's politeness and the promise of aftershocks all in one thing.
Well, you know, I started writing some of these poems long before the 2016 election about the pressures on women to be ladylike in their lives. I had actually written the libretto for an opera called Lotus Lives with a Chinese-American composer, which dealt with how women are alienated through their childhood educations from some of their authentic feelings. And the original title was Upbringing. And I had not really explored it in the Southern idiom until now. And yet, the way I became a Southern writer was I was a Southern reader for many decades first.
Right.
So, you know, I understand that one does not show one's bosom and the plantation culture before 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
And other little tidbits like
that. Yes. My bosoms tend to not be on display as a general principle, but it's good to know.
It's good to know there are rules for such things. Now, every section begins with juxtaposed quotations from the Book of Revelation and Emily Post.
Yes.
So how did you fasten upon that idea?
Well, I think that it doesn't matter where one sits on the political spectrum right now in the United States. A lot of us are feeling like something has shifted in our culture that feels perilous. And people on both sides of the political spectrum feel that way. And within Christian parlance, we talk about living in end times. So the Book of Revelation has always been a point of discussion of oppression and difficulty for people who mean to do the right thing. And the thing that I found was that it's almost like you've got a drone shot from far above a crowd in every part of the Book of Revelation. But I started writing poems about first-person experiences of hegemony and oppression. Mm-hmm. And I started giving myself little assignments that I found entertaining. Like, if you had 5 minutes before you were raptured, what kind of note would you leave?
Right.
So I was writing these poems, and I was writing other poems just about being ladylike. And I was someone who had campaigned for Hillary Clinton to win the election. I worked with Louisiana voters here who felt the same way. And when she lost, I realized that these poems really belonged together for this time. Mm-hmm. And hence, it becomes a question of how do people who have been disappointed survive such a season? And to what extent, if any, is being ladylike at all helpful? Right. It may not be helpful at all. This book is ironically titled Polite Occasions.
Absolutely. The discomfort of polite occasions comes through very clearly in the title poem. I mean, now, some of these poems, of course, as you might expect, are a little grim, just a little grim. Now, one of my favorites is the Welcome Wagon poem, and it's how to accept a welcome wagon basket, and it turns into a meditation on all the terrible things that could have brought a new person to a neighborhood.
Yes. I was glad that really none of those things had happened to me.
Right.
And certainly not moving to New Orleans. But there was a brief period where my husband and I lived in a suburban and fishbowlish community. And I have never been so close to pulling a Sylvia Plath and sticking my head in the oven as I was when I lived there.
Oh, glad you didn't.
I'm glad that we found another solution, and New Orleans is a good place for people who don't like those kinds of smug, gated, all-white communities.
And I'm glad you're not in the witness protection program as well.
Yeah, because postal was another option, but I'm too much of a lady.
Of course, I can tell. And How To was a poem that struck home with me for any number of reasons, and it is a fabulous set of directions for accepting expressions of sympathy. And it ends with this note, remember that less is more, less is also less, less is loss, loss is less.
I'll tell you where I got the idea for it. I was always a reader of Martha Stewart Living when she was the editor. And the thing that I found fascinating as someone reading it in New York City, where I lived at the time, was the cognitive dissonance between her real life and the life of the magazine. Like, she would write these fireside chat kinds of endnotes about sitting near the fireplace, roasting chestnuts with her husband, Mark, from whom she had been divorced for decades by the time she writes the note. And I was fascinated by that space she chose to create, a world that didn't really exist for her. And then she went to jail, as we all know. And right. She came out. And I noticed that she even went full throttle more into this sort of prim, ladylike, preppy existence. And I was fascinated. Like, some small detail that I saw was she had bought these horses. I don't remember the name, where the horses have a naturally black fur if they stay out of the sun. But if they go in the sun like normal horses do during the day, they turn brown. She paid people to exercise her horses at night so they would stay black. How gothic is that?
Oh, wow.
And she had always, of course, been the queen of organization. But I saw this room shortly, a photo spread that she had approved, if not taken photos for a room where the ribbons for a gift wrapping room were thoroughly organized. And my first response in looking at this picture of these rigidly, fascistically organized ribbons was, oh, my God, that poor woman. She's been through so much. And so I started to think about what tips might Martha Stewart have for a major tragedy. And so the poem is not in Martha Stewart's voice. It's in my own. But it occurred to me that the language that women have been taught to speak in is the language of cookbooks. If you look at women's history, so much of it is embroidery samples and cookbooks in American publishing.
Absolutely.
Publishing, I say with air quotes that you can't see on the radio, publishing for women up until a couple generations ago was all about being able to maybe read a poem at the ladies' club or have an embroidery sample. It's not an accident that Emily Dickinson, one of our first women poets, the terseness of her prosody resembles, in my view, the terseness of embroidery samples that girls were taught to make during the pre-Civil War era. I actually have some photographs of those that I have framed near the space where I work because it keeps me humble when I'm sitting down to write and remembering all the women who never had the opportunity to publish anything in a public forum other than in that way.
And I remember Emily Dickinson writing on envelopes.
Yes.
Stitching those envelopes too. But when I think of Martha, I think of there's this wonderful moment in that Christmas special with Julia Child, and Martha's making a croquembouche. And Julia Child just sits back and looks at her and goes, well, good for you. because the whole thing is, for Julia Child, it was always, look what I made for us to share. Let us enjoy this.
Yes.
And for Martha, it's always, look what I made. Interesting problem.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And there's a precision to her work that Julia Child was willing to sort of
fling to the wind.
Yes. Which was charming about her. But Martha Stewart likes things a certain way.
So this is the tension that kind of appeals to you in life. I imagine you can see it everywhere. I do.
I think so. I mean, I think in some ways I'm ridiculously old-fashioned. And I was always, like, whatever writing I could find by women, and even in junior high school, I was fascinated with because I already knew I wanted to write. And I didn't see a myriad of examples of women publishing at that time. And I read a lot of etiquette books. Emily Post was not my favorite. Eleanor Roosevelt wrote an etiquette book.
Right.
And I enjoyed reading them, not because I act in a certain way that would suggest that I hold state dinners at my home and I know where to seat the ambassador of Singapore anytime.
I would love to come to a state dinner at your home.
Why, thank you. It would be nice if I had a big enough table for one of those. I do not.
Now, I'm curious about your theater background, because I read that the first real literature that came home to you was Shakespeare. And
yes.
You had read most of Shakespeare by the time you were 14. Mm-hmm. And so many of these poems deal with theater, screenplays, musicals, The Wall in Midsummer Night's Dream, actors.
Well, when I was a kid, in the particular place where I was living, the little community within my high school, the people who sort of tolerated the creative kids, I joke I was not so much an artist as an artist, damn it. I was a little punk rocker with spiky red hair at the time. But the musical theater kids also wanted to be creative. They might not have been artist, damn it. They were more like artists.
Yes.
And, and so I enjoyed dramatic literature, and I particularly loved the Greeks. I was madly in love with Greek theater when I discovered Oedipus the King because of the over-the-top drama, the permission to go whole hog. And Medea was a really interesting figure to me because there was this woman who is playing essentially a Charles Bronson-style revenge drama role within a very patriarchal culture. And I wouldn't have had the vocabulary to tell you all that when I was in high school. But what I did know was that when I thought about writing, I heard things in my head in a certain kind of prosody that lent themselves to dramatic work. My first book of poems, The White Trash Pantheon, sets the ancient Greek myths in the Deep South. And it's pretty much straight on dramatic monologue poems. And it's writing back to all the Southern writers that I've read, as well as the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
I was very honored to win a prize from the Southern Writers Southern Writing Conference for the work that I'd done in that book, which, given that I'm from South Brooklyn, basically, is a very strange thing to happen, because that conference exists to say only Southerners understand how to write about the South and understand the South. And here they were saying, no, you have heard us. You have understood us. And also, it was a way to slap the snooty off of 18th century poetry, which I enjoyed, that talked about, oh, Zeus, thou and thy thunderbolts. But instead of doing that, I realized I was teaching a lot of classical literature to college students, and I kept saying, if you grew up in a Judeo-Christian or a Muslim tradition, you understand that there is a law-giving God, and if you obey the laws of the God, there are supposed to be good things that happen to you, and if you disobey, there are supposed to be bad things that happen to you. But you have to get rid of that idea for the Greek gods. The Greek gods, I said, are bitchy. They are like Jerry Springer guests with unlimited power.
So true. So true.
And so I started writing poems in the voices of these gods, like Jerry Springer guests. So, you know, I have Persephone confessing to her mother about, you know, the story of Persephone, just for anybody who doesn't quite remember that from junior high school or high school literature, gets kidnapped by the god of the underworld, and her mother has to essentially negotiate a temporary reprieve for her from this kidnapping so that there can be spring and summer. But I have Persephone start out by saying, Mama, I lied to you. I wasn't kidnapped. And she basically has a boyfriend her mother would never approve of, the god of the underworld, who sounds a little like Elvis in my poem.
Ah, always works for me. Well, speaking of other cultural figures, I want you to read one of your poems for us. And it just, the title alone, The Aging Bond Girl Calls Her Best Friend.
I'd gladly do that. It's pathetic, darling. Not long after I tried to extradite him from Abyssia with scissor kicks and napalm, I started asking questions, Lemon Drop. Tanning on the deck of an arch-villain's race yacht actually left me feeling slightly chilly. Of course, I got a pedicure and forgot it. I moved to Bangkok at the invitation of an opium-dealing silk merchant, ran into James again, used my jujitsu to bamboozle him, but I could not squeeze his head between my thighs to the point of annihilation. I need him, leaving him breathing, but without his secret watch. I called M on it and asked for a job. She laughed, told me I was overqualified to chase spooks. Ma chérie, I can't quite imagine what hit me. In Mombasa, I saw him yet again, jogging, well, on his way to explode a terrorist camp feebly disguised as a German neurosurgeon. I must have felt sorry for him, honey. Why else?
Out of mercy, I aimed my blowgun only at his crotch. But probably because he has left so many sirens disgruntled, he was wearing shorts made of Kevlar and anti-nuclear fibers. And yet he never calls me. I've tried to move on. He never really ages, and I'm in my late 30s, living on the estate of a blonde Viennese wine merchant, feeding his peacock cyanide chicken pellets and training his nubile teenage daughter in aquatic ballet for the next Olympics. To this day, my dearest, I've never really understood what we were fighting about, why I keep finding secretive men so entrancing. And even though I'm still quite lovely for a girl of a certain age, I've never built anything for myself. Well, there is the valise of diamonds I stole back in the late 70s from that sheik. I never delivered them to the handsome man who wanted to make the satellite to destroy American missile silos. Those rocks and the underground plastic explosives factory I opened with my ex-roommate Ludmilla in Prague. But what does it all mean, my little butterfly? Why keep going skiing in Gstaad? Why après ski? Why keep getting thermal treatments at the Geller Spa in Buda? Why keep polishing the same knives? One day, I'd like to bake a pie without any rohypnol in the crust just to see how it flakes.
Oh, it's so hard not to laugh when I listen to that.
Well, I was hoping people might laugh when they were reading and or listening, but I am grateful for your radio silence.
One day I want you to write a poem about the Bond girl reunions.
That could be a chapbook right
that
there.
That could be the whole thing. I think you have channeled them beautifully.
Thank you.
We've been talking with poet Anne Babson about her wonderful new collection, Polite Occasions. Anne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Alex Beard signs The Lion King Tuesday, September 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Justin Nystrom discusses Creole Italian, how Sicilian immigrants shaped the culture of America's most interesting food town. Wednesday, September 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Photographer Ron Calamia discusses his new book, Fantastic Saints, Thursday, September 6th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Bernice McFadden, discusses and signs Pray Song for the Butterflies, Friday, September 7th at 6 at Community Book Center, 2523 Bayou Road. Kavajanae Wallace signs her book, Shay and Emmy's Star in Break an Egg, the most recent in her series of children's books, Saturday, September 8th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. And coming up, the Dickens Fellowship has announced its reading schedule for the novel Little Dorrit this year. Meetings begin Saturday, September 15th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Reading for the first meeting is Book 1, Chapters 1 through 11, open to all Dickens fans. And just a reminder, Barnes & Noble hosts the Monday Night Writers Group every Monday night at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harder Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.